Hello and welcome to the second instalment of the Family Law podcast from Pump Court Chambers. I'm Mark Ablett, and for the next 25 minutes or so, you'll be listening to me and the dulcet tones of my guest and co-host Tara Lyons. Tara was called to the bar in 2005 and is a specialist financial remedies and contentious probate practitioner. She is ranked as a leading individual in Chambers and Partners and the Legal 500, and sits as a private FDR judge, a service which I'm sure we will continue to see gain in popularity even after lockdown ends. Well, after all that, I certainly feel a bit inadequate. Tara, how are you?
Thank you, Mark, for that very kind introduction. I am very well. Good afternoon. And I'm honoured to be on your second podcast. So thank you very much.
Excited about the new logo that we've uploaded since the first episode.
It's very smart.
I think it's very jazzy.
It's very smart. Who knew that barristers could also do such excellent branding?
Who knew? Who knew indeed? So Tara is joining me today to discuss offers, tactics and timings. This is, of course, particularly pertinent at the moment. Changes to the family procedure rules came into effect at the beginning of this month, and we now have to make open offers 21 days after the FDR. I should say at this stage that this does not override the existing direction to serve open offers 14 and 7 days before the final hearing. The other recent change, as I'm sure listeners will be aware of, is the revised Form H, which now includes cost estimates up to FDR and final hearing. And these changes also need to be seen in the context of the relatively new changes to Practice Direction 28A, in particular paragraph 4.4, which identifies that the court will take a broad view of conduct for the purposes of a costs discretion and will generally conclude that to refuse openly to negotiate reasonably and responsibly will amount to conduct in respect of which the court will consider making an order for costs, and that can even be in a needs case. So encouraging earlier open offers, it is clear that lawmakers are pushing negotiations into the open sphere. And we will be discussing, amongst other things, what that means for your approach to proceedings. So, Tara, perhaps firstly, let's talk about what the actual point is in making an open offer versus a without prejudice offer.
Well, Mark, there are a number of points. First and foremost, it is a way of exerting pressure on the other side to start thinking about how they are negotiating and attempting to reach a settlement in this. And that's because it is only open offers that can sound in cost consequences. And we've had that added push from FPR 28A 4.4 that you've just alluded to, and makes clear that there could be cost consequences if you don't negotiate reasonably and responsibly openly. Now, what reasonably and responsibly means is a different issue, and I think that's going to come under close scrutiny for the courts. But the answer to your question is, first and foremost, there's a cost reason to negotiate openly. There are a number of other reasons give an advantage for putting forward an open offer, and that's this. As well as the cost protection, it will also make you look pretty reasonable if you've made a fair open offer early in proceedings, and that will give you an enormous advantage at the final hearing. There's also an advantage if you pitch the open offer correctly. So, for example, if you make an early open offer where there are more capital resources available, and you offer the wife, let's say, 55% of a net asset pot of 600,000, and then by the time it gets to final hearing, that pot has been depleted by 100,000. Then for the wife to persuade the court that they should have any cost protection, they're going to have to show they're going to have to achieve more than 66% at the final hearing rather than that initial 55%. So it's a really persuasive argument, isn't it, for making an early open offer?
Yeah, absolutely. And you, I suppose it's like you say, it's forcing the other side into making a decision earlier than perhaps they were expecting to, and tactically that has to be a good thing. In terms of, so there's a cost of consequences, but in terms of timing for an open offer, you've mentioned the benefits of an early open offer. What are your views in terms of when we ought to be making these offers then?
Well, I think you've got to think about them in the three principal stages. The first point to remember is making an open offer does not necessarily mean making a complete offer on all the issues between the parties. It is perfectly open to you to consider making an issue-specific offer. So I think it would be good practice to always consider, is there a point early on, whether just before the first appointment or soon afterwards, where you could look to make some sort of issue-specific offer at that point. The next key stage where I think you've really got to think about making an open offer is just before the FDR. And my view is that if you are able to make sensible without prejudice offers, then there would be no reason that you couldn't convert some of those into an open offer, because no doubt you'd consider that you had all the relevant disclosure and information available to do that. And then the next point is after the FDR, and that's been reinforced with these new rule changes.
So in terms of just before the FDR, then the idea, I guess, is that you're saying, this is my open position, this is what I'm going to go to trial on, this is what you stand to lose if you are not sensible and you don't settle, and you're hedging your bets on getting an indication in line with at least your without prejudice offer.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, how many cases can you think of, Mark, where in fact the open offer that is put forward is pretty much in line with your sort of starting position for FDR in any event? I mean, the key thing to remember is with open offers, they have to be arguable. So don't ever include that point that you might throw in for FDR purposes that really you know you're going to lose, because that will weaken your position at any sort of final hearing. But ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, there's no reason that you shouldn't be making an open offer at the same time as that you might make a without prejudice offer. And if there are any doubts, for example, if you're worried that there's going to be a change of circumstance, let's say one of the parties is moving accommodation, that's going to have an effect on their housing need, you can always state that the offer is made on a certain basis.
So I suppose the consideration, and we both see it in our practice, one of the obstacles to settlement that's described is non-disclosure. And I was talking about this with Annie Ward last time. Can you be making an open offer when disclosure is potentially incomplete? So you're getting to an FDR and there are still question marks over one side's disclosure. Doesn't that slightly weaken your hand if you're prepared to settle without knowing everything?
Well, I think, as with all things, it is. It depends, doesn't it? It depends firstly on the sort of level of non-disclosure that we're talking about and what your real concerns might be. If you're concerned that actually the husband might have an additional account that he opened post-separation, and you know that he's a PAYE earner, and the sorts of likely sums he might have earned and might have been able to squirrel away, and you're convinced they're not very high, then after a long marriage of, let's say, 30 years, you know that the end result is going to probably be pretty 50-50 on the house. Well, in those circumstances, there's no issue with you making that early open offer. If, however, this is really a maintenance case and you haven't got full disclosure of the husband's income, well, of course, you're going to be much, much more careful and you probably won't make an open offer. But that's not to mean that you couldn't make some open statements, for example, that this would be an ongoing maintenance award and that quantum would be dependent on the disclosure that he would put forward.
Right. I mean, I suppose the other thing that we have to bear in mind, and this is enforced at the moment by the new rule changes, we have to make this offer after FDR, but of course we're making that offer before we see Section 25 statements. And one likes to think that that is not a completely pointless exercise, because it generally costs our clients quite a lot of money. So what are your views on that, that we're effectively being asked to settle before seeing what's supposed to be the substance of the case either way?
Well, I think that particular point you've raised actually informed a lot of the debate when considering this rule change, because it's exactly that. What's the point of making these open offers before statements are produced? I suppose there are two things. First of all, although we've spoken about open offers being made 21 days post FDR, in fact, the rules give you a get out clause. So part 9.27A says, where at an FDR appointment the court does not make an appropriate consent order or direct a further FDR appointment, each party must file with the court and serve on each other, on the other party, an open proposal of settlement by such date as the court directs, or where no direction is given, under subparagraph A, within 21 days after the date of FDR appointment. So it is always open for you, if you have real concerns that there's going to be some new information in the Section 25 statements, to say, well, actually, we don't think this is a case in which it would be appropriate for open offers to be made soon after the FDR. And indeed, the case that the FDR I dealt with last week, there was exactly that submission to the judge, who in that particular case felt, no, it wasn't appropriate. But of course, if actually Section 25 statements have been ordered, not because it's a particularly contentious case, but because it would be far quicker to have the evidence in statements, and we might see some sort of updating information in the statements, then I don't see that you're going to particularly prejudice your client in making an open offer based on the information you have at that time.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, it's got to be case specific, hasn't it? Moving on slightly, we've been talking obviously about open offers only. The other big area on offers is without prejudice. I suppose the big question is really, how do your tactics differ and the content differ when it comes to making without prejudice offer versus open offer?
Well, my practice has always been that when it comes to open offers, you'd be best advised to keep those offers as succinct and bullet point as possible. Because if you go into a detailed explanation as to the division you're seeking or the order that you're seeking, then it becomes very easy at a final hearing to effectively erode those points and that offer by challenging the individual points. So for open offers, I think it's best to keep it as brief as possible, and as I say, a sort of bullet point approach. For without prejudice offers, my approach is always to give much more detail, because it's the reasoning then that might persuade the other party that actually, you know, it's for these reasons they should accept the offer. It's always a good idea, following an FDR, if you can, to make your sort of best without prejudice offer at the same time as the likely open offer that you're going to be making at the final hearing, or the open offer under the new rules. And that's because it shows in stark contrast what the other party might get at final hearing, or the best offer which you're offering at that point. And I find that is often an incentive, particularly after a day in court, a difficult day in court at an FTR, to just give the other side that final push to get to your level and agree a settlement. So I think that's tactically an important way to think about the juxtaposition of the two offers together.
And just to complicate the plot, of course, we know that colder bank offers were got rid of in 2010 with the rule change, save for certain applications, one of which is maintenance pending suit and legal service provision order applications. I suppose there, where it's without prejudice, save us to cost, in terms of tactics, you're going to be more in line with the open offer tactics than the without prejudice tactics, aren't you?
Yeah. Exactly right. And I mean, one of the differences, though, when you're thinking about the colder bank rules that apply in that situation is, you know, the aim is to beat your offer. Now, with the open offers, it's not really clear what our aim is because of this new rule at 4.4, which is to offer reasonably and sensibly. You know, what is that? Is that beating your offer at court? Is that beating the other side's offer at court? And I think that's going to make things much more complicated. But you're right. It is important to be a bit more tactical about your WP offers in those discrete applications because of the colder bank rules.
But let's just say, moving on then to touch on the new changes. Like you say, there's no, presumably we're going to be waiting for that first juicy High Court authority, hopefully a dynamic Mr. Justice Mostyn judgment, where reasonableness is, or some definition is ventured towards reasonableness.
Yes.
We're just arguing in a vacuum at the moment, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And I think the thing is, in our search for a definition of reasonableness or responsible, I think this is going to become one of those areas of law, another area of law in family proceedings, which is discretionary. And it's going to be very difficult to advise clients. And there is also the risk that it will encourage parties to take it to final hearing in the hope that they'll achieve a cost.
Yeah, I want to come to that in a moment, but firstly, just to sort of round off on offers themselves, in terms of timings, what we haven't talked about is how long your offer should be open for. And of course, that depends on when you make it. But perhaps the best example is this post-FDR offer that we now have to make. And say it is 21 days after the FDR, you've got Section 25 statements coming at some point after that. How long would you be saying that offer should stay open for, particularly when you then, if you're the applicant, have to make your another open offer 14 days before the final hearing?
Well, I think certainly I think you should be making time limited offers, and I don't think that well, particularly because there is that opportunity. Well, you're required to make an additional offer prior to the final hearing, but you have to gauge that, don't you, on when your side is going to start incurring many more costs, which would make your offer unattractive. And I would have thought that a reasonable period would be something like 14 days. However, you know, you can always gauge it by the next step. So if actually you've got to start work on your Section 25 statement, you can use that as the marker. And I don't think you'd be criticised for being unreasonable.
I suppose we'll almost be led by the court listings, which, let's be honest, we're not going to be optimistic about when we get our final hearings after FDR at the moment. So just then to touch on what you mentioned earlier, the point of these revised timings, the 4.4 of PD 28A seem to be they want to encourage people to negotiate, settle earlier. Do you think that's actually going to happen?
Well, I think there's going to be, I think in the majority of cases, it is going to mean that many more open offers are made earlier. I think, however, that it will be possible to use the loophole that I described earlier, which is to ask the court for more time. But I think what we will find is that the offers that come out will be far more conditional. You know, whether that will make more cases settle earlier, we'll have to see because of the cost implications.
But there is that risk, isn't it? That if someone thinks that they've actually got a shot at getting a costs order versus the usual no order, that it almost might encourage them to go to final hearing, depending on the stage of proceeding.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's an unfortunate byproduct, because it's very clear what the intention was with this. And, you know, and I think that intention is right, because there are so many cases where people delay and don't try and narrow the issues and make an open offer at the very last minute, you know, a couple of days before the final hearing at huge cost to the parties.
Yeah, and I think it's important, isn't it, that we're not talking about High Court or only High Court high value cases here. The practice direction specifically says needs cases. So these are tactics that need to be borne in mind regardless of what the net assets are.
Yeah, I think it's going to bring about a change in mindset for family practitioners, and will encourage, I think it's going to mean that people hopefully will have a better handle of their cases. And that should narrow the issues, because we'll see far earlier what actually there is to fight about on an open basis.
Well, thanks for that, Tara. I think that's probably as much as we've got time for. I'm enough of a law nerd to say that I really enjoyed that chat. I hope our listeners found it entertaining and useful, or will find it entertaining and useful. So it seems that the lawmakers want us to be negotiating more openly. There is a suggestion that failure to do so will be punished by costs, even in needs cases. And so it does make thinking about tactics all the more important, regardless of what the net asset figure is. It, of course, also brings us back to what is seemingly an ongoing conversation around whether Colderbank offers should be revived, but that really is a discussion for another day. Coming soon on the Family Law Podcast, I'll be joined by Paul Mertens of Plump Court Chambers to talk about special advocates in family proceedings, and by James Byrne and Alice Scott, also of Plump Court, to talk about the interplay between possession proceedings under Practice Direction 51Z of the CPR and enforcement of financial remedy orders. Tara will also be hosting bite-sized guides to those thorny applications you know about but rarely have to make, and more on that coming soon. Otherwise, thank you very much, Tara. Thank you,
Mark.
As ever, do send any topic suggestions our way. My email is m.ablett@pumpcourtchambers.com. This has been the Family Law Podcast. Goodbye.